The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com.
There are business leaders that are making so much more than profit in their enterprises. They're elevating their businesses, teams, and themselves to add more value. And so can you. Welcome to the Business Elevation Show with host Chris Cooper. If you are looking for ways to elevate success while contributing to a better world, you'll want to listen for the next hour. Now here's your host, Chris Cooper.
Hi, this is Chris Cooper, and wonderful to be back with you for yet another week on the Business Elevation Show. And now, last week, we had Dori Clark on the show, and we talked about standing out. I thought it was a fascinating show about how you can become a recognized expert in your field. But of course, if you stand out, what you have to do is you have to build a reputation. I was really thrilled this week. Myself and my team, we were delivering work for 70 international MBA students at the University of Leicester for their MBA summer school. And we did work, myself and a colleague, last year. I was doing some guest speaking. And this year I did a guest speaking slot around the power to get things done. And my colleague, John, did a couple of days of training around leadership. And another of our team, Tracy, she delivered some work around communication. And the feedback from the client was fantastic. They said they'd never, it's so rare to find people who can engage students like that. But what I think we've done over the years is we've built a reputation. And I know next year we'll do more things with that client, but we're building and cementing that reputation through, you know, a lot of hard work and making sure that we do things well. But if you were asked right now how much your reputation is worth, what would you say? You know, it's hard to put a monetary value on something that might seem intangible. But if your reputation were damaged or it was ruined, you'd be willing to pay almost anything to get it back. And there's all sorts of high-profile examples like Tiger Woods, for one, and many people like that who I'm sure would pay almost anything to get that reputation back. We're going to talk about reputation with my guest today, Mike Mooney. But communicating ideas, shaping both athlete and brand images while building and protecting reputations has been the heart of Mike Mooney's efforts for more than two decades in the motorsports arena. He's launched and led high-profile sponsorships for companies such as Sprint, Walmart, Johnson & Johnson, Mercedes-Benz. And he saw a trend in the early 2000s between how reputations were being managed and the impact of an instantaneously connected global community via social media. He saw a consistent disconnect between two key elements that drive strong reputations, that's values and behavior. And his experiences led him to write Reputation Shift, 5 High Performance Truths to Win in the Reputation Economy, a values-based approach to harnessing the power of reputations for leaders, entrepreneurs, anyone looking to succeed, not only in business, but in life. And that book, we're getting a bit of a sneak preview of the content today because that book comes out in the autumn. Fascinatingly, Mike is currently Senior Vice President of Business Operations for Roush Fenway Racing, one of NASCAR's premier racing organizations. And so a very, very exciting sector to be working in. So a huge welcome today to my guest, Mike Mooney.
Thank you, Chris. Really appreciate you having me on today.
Wonderful to talk to you, Mike. I'm fascinated by your background and you know, the exciting role that you find yourself in. And I'm interested, you know, what was your childhood like, and you know, where did this interest for motor racing come from?
Yeah, it's a great question. Starting back then, you know, it's funny. My dad raced on a local level. I'm originally from New York, and he was a test driver, a great mechanic. And I was the son who consistently handed him the wrong wrench every time he asked. You know, so I just honestly figured that wasn't going to be my path, you know. But, you know, life's pretty ironic. You know, you hang around things when you're at a young, impressionable age and you learn about sports. But I was really more interested on the business side of sports. So, you know, as I look back and I think about the times in my dad's shop when his buddies were either watching the race on TV or listening on the radio, talking about some big names like, you know, Dale Earnhardt or Richard Petty, Darrell Waltrip, Rusty Wallace, you know, some of the greats of NASCAR. And then I fast forward to my 20s and 30s, and here I am having the opportunity to have worked with some of these legends of the sport. You know, it's life's pretty amazing in that sense. And I think that and his buddies might think I've done pretty well since then.
Actually, could you tell us, tell us just a little bit about NASCAR, because I've heard of it. I'm obviously British. I live in the UK, and we have a lot of international listeners to the show. So I apologize to those who are American and do understand NASCAR. But how is NASCAR distinct from, say, Formula One, which is something that I recognize and follow?
Sure. First, the easiest way to make that distinction between NASCAR, Formula One, is just the general style of the bodies of the cars. You know, we actually have fenders on our cars here, Chris, and it makes for closer racing competition. You know, we race primarily on oval tracks, ranging from a half mile to over 2.5 miles, whereas Formula One, primarily the open wheel racers, will be on road courses globally, you know, where we're primarily based here in North America.
And is that oval track, is that because it's more, it enables it to be observed by the spectators in an easier kind of manner, because you can watch them spinning around rather than them disappearing around loops and bends as in Formula One? Is it part of the spectacle that it's an oval?
It is part of the spectacle, for sure. But also, if you think about the engineering and the physics, our cars have a higher center of gravity, more so than the Formula One cars. So having banked corners allows our cars to carry higher speeds because of the force that it puts on our cars to keep them on the ground. So really, it's a bit of the physics and the ability for these guys to race. And yeah, it is about the promotion in the show as well.
And it must be, highly dangerous, isn't it, going around at that speed? Because these cars are reaching, a couple of hundred miles per hour, is that correct?
Yeah, they are. You know, we're reaching speeds over 200 miles an hour, sometimes, 215, 220. But NASCAR has, over the past 15 years, done an amazing job of working on the safety components of the sport for the driver. And how they've changed the inside, what they call the greenhouse of the car, making more room in there for the driver. There are more safety, harnesses for the heads and lap belts. But more importantly, too, around the racetracks, they've instituted what they call safer barriers. In years past, the walls of these tracks were mainly concrete, which they still are. But, several years back, they created these safer barriers that have styrofoam cushions between the wall and where the driver would hit. So it actually absorbs a lot of the impact and G-forces that the driver would have normally experienced. So as fast as they go and as crazy as it seems, it is very safe.
So how did you get to be senior vice president of one of the premier NASCAR teams? What led you to that?
Yeah, well, I guess if you hang around any industry for 20-some-odd years, right, you can just keep faking it. Now, seriously, it's something where, I look back and I was blessed with some amazing mentors early in my career who took some big bets on me and allowed me some big opportunities to work with some very big brands, some of which you mentioned earlier in the intro, and thank you for that. That was very kind of you. But the big brands and big athletes, and as you know, I mean, there's no shortcuts for hard work. So just, working my tail off day in and day out was really, I would say, that many people have found in careers, that path to success, the overnight success that took 20 years to make, that story goes, But I'd say, it's going to sound cliche. I'll tell you the career, the first part of the career story, but my first job in the motorsports industry was with a public relations agency where I literally managed their warehouse. I stuffed media kits. I changed light bulbs and, really looked at that as a foot in the door. And a short story that really stuck with me was one day I was out in the warehouse just going through the area, and this older gentleman came in and he was just observing the warehouse and made a comment, "Hey, it looks really good out here. You're doing a good job. Is this what you want to be doing?" And I said, "Well, clearly not. I'd like to move up and do more within the sport and public relations, but you have to start somewhere, right?" And he kind of smiled and said, "Well, just keep this in mind. It's not where you start, it's where you end up." Mm. I said, "Okay, very sage advice. Thank you." Well, later in the day, I was talking with the owner of our agency, and I had met this gentleman back there, and he asked me what he had said, and I recounted the story to him, and my boss kind of chuckled, and he said, well, do you know who that was? I said, no, I know it was Paul. And he said, well, that's Paul Bafico. Paul, at the time, 15, 20 years ago, said, Paul is the president and CEO of Sears Roebuck and Company. And he started his career on the loading docks in Chicago. So listen to what he has to say. Keep working hard. So, you know, it's stories like that and people who have crossed my path that have been very helpful.
I love that. I've probably mentioned this before on shows, but there's a quote that I like. I think it was by Tony Robbins, and I recall it quite often to people, which is, you know, people significantly overestimate what they can achieve in a year, but significantly underestimate what they can achieve in 10.
So true. Yeah, that is so true. You know, and that's where, you know, the path picks up. And having had the opportunity, like, over those times, 10, 15 years, to see the sport from several different perspectives and disciplines. You know, I've been on the agency side. I've been on the brand side as a sponsor. You know, I'm now with Roush Fenway. I'm on the property side and have been able to work in different areas in public relations, marketing, and now operations for the team. So, you know, I'd say that for me, I'm always trying to learn, I've been fortunate to be able to do it in this particular industry in motorsports. It's been so much fun.
Well, it's great that with a busy job that you're taking the time out to write a book. But you know, in that day, I imagine you're a busy guy. What's a typical day like in the life of Mike Mooney? You know, working on operations at Roush Fenway.
Yeah. So yeah, thank goodness that there isn't a typical day, which is great because I love change. I love that's what I loved about the agency life. You know, you get to work with various clients, and that's what we do here. Quite honestly, you know, if you think about the NASCAR season, we have the longest sports schedule in North America. We have 38 races, so it's 38 weekends over 52. So it's easy to do the math to see how many off weekends.
Oh, yeah,
it's generally December and January, but we're working just as hard then. But you know, if you look at our race season and what we're doing for partners, we actually model our internal teams like an agency. And that's what I focus a lot of my time around. So I can go from one meeting where we talk about tools and power tools and fasteners for one of our partners, Fastenal. You know, the next meeting could be about how we're going to drive the health and wellness message for the diabetes community for our partner, Lilly Diabetes. You know, another meeting can be about a retail consumer activation plan for Sunny D, which is another one of our sponsors. So, you know, I spent a lot of my time working on partner programs for the beer brands and how we can make those brands stronger, more competitive through the association with our team in NASCAR. And then I focus a lot on the Roush Fenway Racing brand itself too. How are we enhancing and building that brand as well?
Ah, that leads very nicely because, you know, reputation is clearly important for your brand. And you know, is that what got you interested in reputation? You know, where's this interest in this particular subject come from?
Yeah, you know, and it's true. It kind of found me in a way, which you know, working for the agencies or brands from NASCAR to IndyCar, drag racing, offshore powerboat racing, and working on, you know, communication strategies, crisis plans, speaking points, you know, prepping and coaching the executives and drivers. You know, all those years, I was really becoming a student of reputation, of how to build them, protect them, shape them. You know, in our world in motorsports and what we do with brands and sponsorships, it's about associating this relationship between the brand and the athlete. And behavior and reputations are such critical linkage points in that relationship.
So how would you define it? Do you have a definition for reputation?
I do and I don't, right? You know, Webster has their definition. It's very well thought out and very academic. You know, I try to look at things a little more practical. So here's how I approach that definition or how I look at reputations. Your reputation speaks for you when you aren't there to speak for yourself.
Mm.
You know, and that's really been the basis of how I've approached reputation management from a personal standpoint, you know, because there's corporate brand reputation, but now I'm really thinking about the personal side of things. And the interesting thing, Chris, I found, like, over the years, you know, whenever we would do a debrief on a crisis situation, you know, or whether it be ours or someone else's or what have you, you know, this kept popping up with me that, you know, it could have been avoided if a different decision had been made, you know, and more often than not, it seemed as though, you know, the person who was at the center of the issue had, like, taken their own gun out of their own holster, aimed it at their foot, and pulled the trigger. You know, and we see this in the news, right? We see with politicians, see with executives. Hey, Ryan Lochte, does that strike a chord? You know, the Olympic swimmer over here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so that's more often than not, Chris, these reputation challenges have been self-inflicted. And that's really what stood out to me. And as, again, as I thought about how you look at reputations, that phrase of it's speaking for you when you aren't there to speak for yourself, I believe resonates.
And it's, you know, it's a great example in here. And, you know, somebody with 12 gold medal, Olympic gold medals, you know, must have been an American hero, and how quickly he, you know, damaged his reputation, you know.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, not only his, but, you know, there's the halo effect of those who are associated with him, which is why you saw in one day all four of his, you know, personal services endorsers drop him.
Yeah.
You know, he lost close to, the estimates are close to $1 million in revenue in endorsement deals because brands did not want to be associated with him and that reputation for fear of how it would, you know, rub off on them.
Yeah, they're looking for, you know, brands that give them a leg up as opposed to a leg down, aren't they?
Absolutely. So, you know, the irony is, you know, he won in Rio, but he lost back home in America. And it's going to take him a long time to get past that, quite honestly.
Well, the truth is we'd never actually really heard of him, particularly over here. And he wasn't someone with a household name, but he's somebody we know of now.
Absolutely.
You know, quick. Right, well, we're going to commercial break now, but after the break, we're going to come back. We're going to find out, talk about Mike's book and some of the key takeouts. There's a wonderful quote in there by Morten Albeck, which I want him to share with us. And we'll look at things like, you know, what to do when you're facing a potential disaster, PR-wise, reputation-wise, and something called one degree of behavior. So we'll be back with you again in a couple of minutes. Do stay with us.